Full Service Radio programming is available on our website, fullserviceradio.org, and as a podcast, thanks to Simplecast. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Hello there, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David Nicky Nellis. This is a show where we take deep dives into sometimes serious subjects, sometimes not. Today it's pretty serious because in big cities.
But serious doesn't mean boring. Serious
I'm
can
never
still
boring.
Mean interesting.
Oh, I'm never boring.
Sometimes you're boring.
Unless we're at home and you tell me how boring I am. But
right.
Today I'm not boring. But in major cities, there are socioeconomic gaps between haves and have-nots, and more often than not, the folks who you would call have-nots also suffer from something called a grocery gap, where they live in neighborhoods where they do their shopping.
That term is coined by one of our guests today.
I'm going to attribute it to her if I can get a word in.
Get
here.
In.
Boy, oh
do
boy.
It.
But the point is, we're here. We're going to be talking about food access in the big cities, in particular Washington D.C. We have three guests with us today. Lauren Schwader Beal of DC Greens. You know what? I'm going to let you explain what DC Greens does. Beverly Wheeler of DC Hunger Solutions and Philip Samble of Good Food Markets.
Why don't we start from the beginning? So Lauren is the one who really got in touch with us to talk about doing a panel about sort of food insecurity that's going on here in the city. And each of you participate in rectifying this problem in different ways. So, Lauren, why don't we start with you, since you were the initiator of this, and tell us a little bit, just a tiny bit about your background and how you became a part of this.
Sure. Well, I'm the executive director of DC Greens and the co-founder. DC Greens is an organization here in the city that advances food justice with the levers of food education, food access, and food policy. We really take as our core tenet that access to healthy food is a basic human right. And when we're talking about food justice, to us that really means recognizing that there are structural inequalities that we have to work to address. This isn't just about putting food in people's hands today. It's about making sure that all of our systems, all of the sectors of our city are really weaving food education and food access into the fabric of the city. So our healthcare system, our school system, our built environment. And also for us, food justice is really about making sure that we're moving away from a direct service model and really towards a model of direct collaboration with
okay.
the people that are most impacted.
I'm going to stop you right there. You're saying a lot of really fascinating things, but I need you to break it down a little bit.
Sure.
Because I feel that for some people who maybe know a little bit about this situation, they're not going to understand a lot of what you're saying.
Yeah.
So when you talk about food justice, how does your organization address it?
In so many ways. I mean, honestly, DC Greens, we work across sectors. So, one example, we run the city's produce prescription program where doctors are writing prescriptions for fresh fruits and vegetables that can be redeemed at any of the farmers markets in the city.
But let's talk about, let's go deeper into that, because the fact that a doctor has to write a prescription so a little boy or girl can get fresh fruits so that he or she will have a modicum of health is scary in the wealthiest country in the world.
That's
that throws
right.
away more food than we actually need to feed everybody.
That's
okay,
right.
We'll get to food waste towards the end of the show.
We're allowed to say things. That's fucked
yeah,
up.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And I think, what we're finding, at least in the healthcare sector, is that the connections have really been made now between food insecurity, which is what people used to call hunger, but now is really the, for those who aren't familiar with the mm-hmm. sector, people talk about it as food insecurity because it's basically, the question that gets asked of folks when they're coming into clinics is, at any point in the past 12 months, have you been worried that you weren't going to be able to feed your family?
Or have a meal, right?
And if someone answers yes to that question, that really points to a lot of very difficult choices that person is making. And what they've found is that if you screen positive for food insecurity, your risk of hypertension, diabetes, you know, all of these diet-related chronic illnesses just goes through the roof. I mean, you know, there's a direct relationship here. And so, in fact, the healthcare system, I think, is the perfect place to be addressing this issue. And really, it's a
because
place...
Because nutrition goes hand in hand.
That's right. And, you know, I think that's a new realization for... I mean, the Washington Post had a piece, you know, last week, I think, talking about how doctors really are given no training in nutrition. It's almost
amazing.
A new idea at this point. It's such an old idea, food as medicine.
Right.
But, you know, we are really just coming back around to that. And so, you know, what DC Greens does, you know, we do sort of both programming and advocacy. And so, yes, we're running this program, but we're simultaneously, you know, talking to DC Health and talking to the council to try and put money into programs like this, trying to think about what kind of Medicaid waivers we could have, you know, really collecting data that is going to make a strong case that we need to be investing in this kind of access.
I want to turn to Beverly Wheeler, because how is the mission and mandate for DC Hunger Solutions different, or how does it dovetail with what Lauren was just talking about?
So, Beverly Wheeler, Director of DC Hunger Solutions, we're really collaborative with DC Greens. So, for us, we also believe, on our card it says we're ending hunger in the nation's capital. I agree. There is no reason why anyone in the most powerful city in the most powerful nation in the known universe
until today,
should be hungry.
Yes.
Well, okay, right. We may have to change
that. Forget Helsinki.
So, okay, so no one should be hungry. So ours is to end hunger. So what I like to talk about is the same thing that Lauren was just talking about. It's not enough just to get people food. Our job is to end hunger. That means getting people jobs. That's make sure people have health care. There's a living wage. They have some place to live. What we do know for sure is that rich people may not eat well, but they are not hungry.
Right.
Okay, so we know that. So we look at full utilization of all the federal nutrition programs. So we're talking SNAP, WIC for women, infants, and children. We're talking about all the school nutrition programs, after school programs, breakfast, lunch. Summer meals are in place. If you know a kid that needs summer meals, we have found out that there a number of them need food, and I can talk about the stats on that later. But that's one of the ways. All the federal nutrition programs. The second thing we do is also an advocacy piece. We take a look at the city's policies, their legislation, and if it's working for food, then we're going to support you on that. If it's hampering people getting food and access to food, we're going to go after it like nobody's business. And if, in fact, it's silent on it, then we will help write legislation to make sure that it's there. And the last thing we do is really educate people about the sheer amount of hunger in the nation's capital. And it is a solvable issue. Okay, we don't need to go crying somewhere. We can solve this, and we know how to solve it.
Okay, why isn't it getting solved?
Wait.
That's a fair question.
It's a very good question. I would like to bring Philip in first. I'd like to introduce him and talk about what he's doing, and then we can sort of pose that question to everybody. Hi, Philip.
Hi, how's it going?
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got into this whole thing?
Sure. So I'm Philip Samble. I'm the executive director of Oasis Community Partners, which operates a social enterprise, Good Food Markets. Good Food Markets' mission is to develop retail solutions in food deserts. So how does it get solved? It gets solved with access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And that's what we do. We build stores that are stocked of, by, and for the community. We staff from the community. We operate job training programs, youth education programs. As an individual, I've worked a number of times with Beverly and Lauren to advocate for better food policy in the district. I serve on the DC Food Policy Council, and we've been working specifically recently on expanding WIC access in the district. So one of these great examples.
Why don't you explain with...
Sure. The WIC program is Women, Infant, and Children. Essentially, it provides groceries of all types specifically geared towards the nutritional needs of pregnant mothers, young children. And is that right, Beverly?
That
did I get
correct.
That right?
Okay.
I should hope so.
Nutritionally at risk.
Right.
Right. Absolutely. And so DC's has, in as a, I think, a consequence of our greater grocery gap, there's a big WIC gap. So you can only redeem WIC in certain stores. And the requirements on retailers to be able to accept WIC benefits in DC are very, very high, some of the strictest in the country. So, for example, a store needs to be 10,000 square feet and have 3 cash register lanes. So this excludes a lot of the stores in Ward 7 and 8.
Would
that, there's only 3 10,000 square foot grocery stores in the whole ward for 75,000 right. people. So what ends up happening, we leave a lot of dollars on the table
and sure.
federal benefits. A lot of mothers are not accessing as
does that
much.
Reflect lobbying? You know,
go ahead.
The history there.
You know, this gets back to.
I think a lot of these policies, and I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt around this, but I think, you know, if you have 3 cash registers, it means you're able to serve people more quickly. If you have a certain size store and a certain amount of different kinds of products in place, it means that they think that what they're doing is providing more options so that you're not.
Do they think about the fact that a lot of people don't have cars and can't get to the 3 stores that exist?
Right. Well, I mean,
there's a lot of barriers.
And these are federal programs.
Right, these
well,
are,
they're,
right.
they're federal programs, but they're local regulations. Right. There was a lot of fraud, and it's very difficult to monitor these stores.
And what about funding? Has the federal government cut any of that funding or not?
Actually, we return a lot of the WIC money.
Because it doesn't get utilized.
Because it doesn't get redeemed.
Don't do that.
And so
many because there's no access.
Not because there's not a need, but because there's so many barriers
and
to
the
access.
Folks who are actually signing up and getting WIC benefits are not actually going and redeeming those dollars. So not only are we leaving dollars, there are mothers who won't even apply because there's no place
there's
to
no
get
place
the
to go.
Food.
I want to just back up for 1 second.
The trouble,
so let's go back
spend the money.
To the grocery store,
yeah.
right?
And so you say there's not the argument against grocery stores and food deserts typically is these people don't want that food and there's not enough spending taking place
right.
in the neighborhood to
but
support
why?
Any store
here.
Right. Okay, so but here's the thing.
And here we're leaving grocery dollars on the table.
But why do these grocery stores have to be behemoths? Why do these grocery stores have to be massive properties? I don't mm-hmm. understand why one equates the other.
The grocery business and the wholesale business that serves it are built on volume.
So it's just the model.
They compete each other to death in the center store. They don't make anything on the 12-pack of Coke or the 24-pack of paper towels. They're making their money on prepared foods. They're making their money on produce, the fresh stuff on the exterior of the store mm-hmm. that needs an expertise. It carries a high labor value, so it demands a higher price. But it's all built. I mean, even the best grocery chains in the world operate on 4-6% net
right.
margins.
But if you think about the European model where you've got a grocer, a baker, a butcher, mm-hmm. you know.
That's all under one roof.
No,
that
you can do.
Supermarket model.
Yeah, you can find and, that. But if you walk the streets, Florence, Italy happens to be some. I live there. You mm-hmm. walk the streets of Florence. There's a patisserie. That's France. Yeah. There's a baker. Mm-hmm. There's a vegetable stand. Mm-hmm. There's a butcher. There's
but
a.
But they do also have massive grocery stores.
They
in
do.
Italy
but
now.
My point is that
they
is and they serve the neighbor. Yeah. You know, if you've ever. I was in Istanbul once. It's a city of 20 million people. You can find fresh vegetables in the smallest, crappiest restaurant anywhere on the European or Asian side. Mm-hmm. So how are they doing it?
I love the concept of shopping European. I think it's absolutely marvelous.
Let's go there.
Yes.
But I'm not working 3 jobs as
right.
a low-wage income
earner.
I gotta
go someplace.
As a single mother
yep.
with 2 children that I have to take to each one of these places.
That's uh-huh. a good point.
I barely have, and my SNAP benefits, if I get them, last about 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. So I need to shop when I can shop. I need to get what I can get.
Right.
I love the concept. I wish we could move it, but it's a really hard thing to ask.
Yes. No, and I think that makes a lot of sense. The question is that now, so the issue with WIC is access with these grocery stores because people can't get to them?
Well, I mean, I would say, I mean, and this is, I think there's an important thing to talk about with WIC specifically that kind of gets to your larger thing. So WIC is a federal policy.
Mm-hmm.
WIC was very much designed with farmers in mind. It is a sort of a small personal allotment And, you know, I mean, there's
you
a
mean
way,
like there, as in so, big ag farmers? Like?
I just mean the agricultural industry. Okay. So, I mean, basically, and I'll talk about the WIC Farmers Market Program, which is a little bit different than the WIC Grocery Program. But the WIC Farmers Market Program, you know, if you are a WIC mother, you know, you get what, $26 for the season? For the season, $26 what? To go to a farmer's market. Okay, so that is not a lot of money to
and
get
is that
you to
a match,
go to,
and then no, can
well,
you match it?
You, in D.C., there are matching programs, and you can additionally get Produce Plus. But I'm just talking about the way that the federal government is thinking about it.
Okay.
So $26, that is not going to change your behavior. It is not going to change your nutrition. But $26 from a whole lot of people is a lot of money for the ag industry.
Yes.
And so a lot of these policies that are coming from the federal level were very much designed not with the low-income customer in mind. Mm-hmm. You know, they're almost like a pass-through kind of additional benefit to sell an ag program around. And I think that it's really important that we start to trouble some of these programs and make sure that we're placing the customer at the center, particularly programs, you know, that are funded and financed by the district itself.
Well, then, Philip, what kind of markets does Good Food Markets set up?
So what Good Food Markets does that's a little different from the supermarket model, which, you know, average 45,000 square feet, is that when we look at a community, say Bellevue and Ward 8, where we'll be opening a store next year, you know, a Safeway would do the market study, and we use the same firm for that market study as Safeway does, and gone, no way, we're never going here. There's not enough rooftops, there's not enough income, there's not enough college degrees, forget about it. What Good Food Markets does is say, okay, here's the spending. If you have a 3,500 square foot store, how big is that market? 3/4 of a mile, a mile. If you have a 5,000 square foot store, can you reach out of a mile? Finding the right size to meet the demand, existing demand in the community. So that's really the first thing we do that's different, small format. The second is that we're funded differently. You know, we are, as I mentioned, a social enterprise of Oasis Community Partners, a nonprofit. So we're able to bring in grants. We're able to bring in program-related investments. We're able to bring in other low-cost or non-recourse debt mechanisms that no LLC would be able to access. That's because, at the end of the day, a break-even scenario is a home run. You know, there is no payoff at the end. There's no financial return on investment. There's a huge social return on investment. And that's the third thing that we do differently, is meaningful community engagement and programming.
And I'd like to underscore something that Philip just said. The fact that college degree is something that is considered when grocery stores are opening, every human needs to eat. I mean, you know, humans are animals. And I think, you know, something that I'm trying to push a lot is, you know, we need to stop thinking of healthy food as a luxury item.
For the elites.
Yeah, I mean, this is not
just at Whole Foods.
Or a consumer good.
Yeah,
I mean, this is 100% a human right.
It's a
utility,
right.
Like water.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, and I've got sort of a soapbox that I know both of you have heard before,
I don't have the actual box, but you can go ahead and do it. Let's hear it.
I mean, I think.
But we do have soap.
You know. For me, you know, with the Flint crisis, it became really clear to me that, you know, across the country, we expect our cities to invest in the infrastructure that's going to guarantee clean water to all people.
Excuse me, look at what just happened in D.C.
That's right.
They fixed it in 2 or 3 days.
Well, wait a second.
We can quibble, but we have clean water today.
We do have clean water today, we think.
And we expect it, though. But we expect it. And it wasn't always that way. And it wasn't until the connection was made between cholera and clean water that cities started to see it as a public health issue that they needed to cover.
Right.
And I think we're in that cholera moment now for food, where, you know, this connection has been made between access to healthy food and all of these diet-related chronic illnesses, and we need to be expecting our cities to build that pipe structure. And it's not giving away food. It is Medicaid waivers. It's cafeterias. It's tax incentives for grocery stores.
It's not a single bullet.
That's right.
It's a multi-pronged process.
Well, but
it
sort of comes under the same, it's kind of a parallel lane to affordable health care. Is it if good, healthy food is a right and not a privilege, and if good, healthy food should be available to everybody and not just if you drive to Bethesda, then, I mean, you have voices against that because they say, hey, this is capitalism and, you know, and Darwin prevails, you know.
But I've got an answer on that one, which
is, let's hear it.
I mean, because I, you know, so with this produce prescription program we've been running, you know, what we've found is that when about half of the patients that are enrolled in the program, they have a, you know, improved individual health metrics. What we've also found is that there's about a 60% increase in patient visits because people are going to see their doctor more frequently because it's a very tangible, you know, if you're food insecure, this is a tangible reason to go see your doctor. And what we're starting to partner now with AmeriHealth, which is DC's largest Medicaid provider, because what they see in that number is the possibility of ER diversion, medication compliance, things
which
that are very costly.
Which all cost more money.
That's right. And so, I mean, even if you take a raw capitalist sort of, you know, what's my return on investment for this, there is a very concrete return on investment to society.
So how are policies...
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I would add one dimension to that, which is think of it, the health, the life expectancy. The discrepancy in life expectancy within DC is huge. It's over 15 years if you look at the highest and the lowest life expectancies by ward. Okay, that's 15 years of earnings. That's 15 years of interest on your house, on your savings. That's 15 years of equity on your home. None of that is getting passed on to the next generation. And when someone gets sick, who's taking care of them? It's usually the wage earner in that household. Mm-hmm. And then there's a lot of people who are diverted from their goals because their older generation in their family is getting ill and they don't have the ability to care for them.
All right. So
and that's where you wind up with these huge racial equity gaps.
All of it from happening. When you walk in and say things that are patently logical like this, who is on the other side going, well, that's bullshit?
Well, actually, I want to just to piggyback on that, Beverly. You said when you introduced what you do, you said we know how to do it. We know how to take care of this hunger issue. How do we take care of the hunger issue?
We actually address it head on. Okay. One of the things that we talk about, we've talked about medical, we've talked about a little bit about jobs. We also need to talk about housing. It is all of that. Okay. And in the District of Columbia, we just happen to be fortunate in that the government does understand this and will take steps toward dealing with it. So it's an educational process, but we also have to stay in the game.
Right.
And that's one thing the three of us do is we're always there supporting the government on, okay, fine, this is a regulation you have in place. It is not helping you. We can help you figure this one out. This is what you need to be doing. This is what it looks like. And this is how we can get partners in the game in order to take care of this. And we can do this. And we do it regularly. And we're not the only three. There's a huge community of us that are beating on this. And I'm sorry to beat my fist, but it really
does. Be careful, you got a shoulder.
I really do get hyper about this because, and this is what I loved about the Candidates Forum on food, is that we said, and there are a group of us who are like, food is going to, when you talk about housing, when you talk about education, you're going to talk about food. And when we call to the candidates to say, you need to be here, they actually showed up, which said they're hearing our message.
Okay. Now, since there are so many, I feel like there's so many groups who are trying to get food on the table to people, right? So are you all clamoring for the same dollars? And do you know what I mean? How do you work together so that you're all going for the same cause, right? And I know you collaborate, but with all these other groups and larger groups, national groups, how do you all work together to ratify this problem?
So when I first got into this space, because I'm an educator by training, so when I first got into the space, I noticed that that was happening. So for me to understand this, I had to think about what I call the food continuum.
Okay.
So there are people who are dealing with grocery stores. There are people who are doing farmers markets. There are people who are doing breakfast in the classroom. There's lunch.
The summer program.
Right, the summer program. After school, senior meals.
Sure.
There's a whole group of people in each of them. So when people come to me and talk about being hungry, if I know that they need medically tailored meals, then I will call my friends at Food and Friends, in order to be able to do that. If I know they need emergency food, then I'll have them call my friends at the Capital Area Food Bank. Mm-hmm. So if I know that they're homeless, then I'll either call Miriam's Kitchen or I'll call DC Central Kitchen. I mean, so it's all those things. And then when we all get to work on this. So, and then when I need policy people, then I know I can go. When I'm thinking about doctors and food prescriptions, and I know I can call Lauren. Lauren, who do I need to send them to?
Okay.
I mean, I would also say, I feel like we've done a lot of really intentional work as a nonprofit community over the past 10 years of really, I mean, I sometimes joke that my job is to like bring the kumbaya, you know, but I really do think that, and some of it is because we're in a city with a lot of wealth.
Yes.
I mean, we are not in a scarcity city in terms of philanthropy.
But not only that, we're in a city, I feel like, that is completely, especially in the last 10 years, involved.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, what we all, we happen to have a lot of very sort of enlightened funders in this area as well, who mm-hmm. recognize that, you know, this isn't an either or. You know, this, you know, for a long time, even DC Council, you know, they would fund one program and then they'd think, oh, well, I've checked the box. Like, I dealt with food insecurity,
sure.
as if that one solution for one tiny segment of, you know, quote unquote, the community was helping everyone. And I think that we've been really successful at kind of joining forces and saying, no, you know, this has to be a both and. And, you know, we are not in competition with each other. And if we're going to really address this issue, food has to be elevated to the same level that we are thinking about housing, education, employment. You know, those are issue areas where, you know, politicians and funders, you know, they know that
maybe
they have
the
to deal
city
with
needs
it.
A deputy mayor for food.
Well, I mean, we've got a food policy director.
That's a great idea.
I mean, this is what I think.
I'm just full of them. I really.
Now, if you can convince the mayor of that, we might be onto something.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation because as we talk about an enlightened city, we need to tell them how to get involved. And we want to talk about what's next. Since we have like the building blocks, the question is how do we build on it and how do we really eradicate this issue? This is David and Nikki Nellis. It's Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. We are in the fabulous Line Hotel, but talking about... It is fabulous. But we're talking about some serious issues here. We'll be back in just a minute.
Service Radio.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, starring the fabulous Nikki Nellis with her runner-up husband, David Nellis. And we're talking to Laura Schwader, Beverly Wheeler, and Philip Samble about...
You only said only part of Laura's name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Laura Schwader Biel.
It's very important.
You're a Biel.
She's
Are you related to Jessica Biel?
She's not. No. You already know she's not.
No? Nope. I'm going to give you your autograph back then. And we've been talking about food deserts in inner cities. And one of the things...
We've been talking about eradicating food deserts and feeding the hungry.
We've been talking about the subject.
Yes.
It's like having my mother run this show. Anyways.
Or like having your wife. Right.
Which is kind of like what it is.
There's a saying in Italian, oi veist mir. And that's what... All right. So, you know, long ago, and I say long ago, 20, 25 years ago, people were talking about urban farming as the way to solve the fresh produce, the lack of fresh produce problem in inner cities.
Well, that wasn't the only thing urban farming was supposed to be doing. Urban farming was also a terrific way to help the environment with all the pollution in the city. I mean, it was a multi-pronged...
Greening the city.
Right.
But now with about a quarter of a century of experience under our belts, there's a sort of a yin and yang to it. Why don't you guys talk about the value of that and the challenges and what else can be done to, you know, leverage that?
Sure. DC Greens has a bit of experience in this space. We run the K Street Farm, which is an acre farm on K Street and New Jersey Avenue, Northwest. And, you know, honestly, I think that in a city like D.C. where, you know, we don't have enormous tracts of land and the cost of land is very high, you know, this isn't Baltimore, it's not Detroit, and that there's a little bit of a misperception that, you know, urban farming is going to fix our food security issue. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of that comes from people just not quite understanding how much land it actually takes to grow food and just kind of a basic misunderstanding about that. I think that, you know, in DC, collectively, we've done a really good job of getting school gardens in place. And in some ways, our school gardens are a really important piece of our, like, urban farming landscape. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times in DC, I think that the value of urban farms is very much about naturalizing the fact that food grows, which is something that gets lost in dense urban environments. I think a lot of it is also about creating peaceful gathering spaces for people to have the kind of emotional benefits of being able to be in spaces. I mean, also, you know, urban gardening, urban farms, it's a lot of different things. You know, there's community gardens that where people are actually able to tend their own plots. Right. There are for-profit farms where people are trying to maximize the space to grow as much produce as possible. I mean, there's a huge range, there's a range of different options. But, you know, I think one of the things that we have an opportunity to do in DC is recognize that historically, you know, urban farms have often been kind of front runners of gentrification and displacement. And they're, you know, sometimes they'll be put in and then, you know, they raise property values and suddenly that blighted lot is actually a beautiful urban farm. And then suddenly the people who actually lived in that community really can't afford the property taxes anymore and have to leave.
And they have to get out, right.
And I think that, you know, there have been enough, you know, decades of information and us seeing this happening in other cities across the country that it's very important that as we start to build farm spaces into our urban landscape that we're really thinking intelligently and sort of proactively about housing policy.
Right, but it's not an amenity, right?
You want people to be altruistic when the istic on the end of their descriptor is capitalistic. I mean, that's the problem. That's the challenge because... Sure, you want people to think that way, but name a developer with a heart who's gonna take less profit.
Well, I think that they're starting to realize, though, that you know, in some ways, they are treating some of these spaces as amenities, and so they are kind of starting to build in green spaces. I mean, you know, we work really closely with JBG Smith, and you know, they're in a lot of conversations about how to, you know, integrate garden spaces into their developments.
Yeah, but without pushing out the people that are already there. That's the challenge. That's what I meant.
Well, that's where you need government.
Right. Philip, what were you going to say?
Well, You know, I think that to start by echoing what Lauren said, this urban farm or garden as educational space is an unbelievable tool.
Mm-hmm.
In so many different ways, exploration in that space can be really transformative for a child. And I think Food Corps has done an excellent job within DC, mm-hmm. Amongst many others. I mean, the work that Aussie and you know, others have done for young people in DC to be exposed to farms outside of the district and growing within the district in their own neighborhoods is really amazing. What I think is, you know, the capitalist angle is that, you know, if we don't do something really soon, your beautiful new developments are going to be under 20 feet of water.
Mm-hmm.
And what benefit does that have to any capitalist? By the time you're actually pulling yield off that 40-year investment, it's going to be too hot to live here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the opportunity that urban agriculture represents is much more systemic. We are able to process our organic waste a lot better if we have more places to do it. We can, you mentioned, green the city. We can also cool the city. We can filter our water. We can retain our water. We can take less from the environment and put more in if we look at urban agriculture as part of development. And that's someplace that the district has really stepped up as well. You know, we talked about the WIC earlier. I mean, the end of that story is that DC Health has been working really hard to modernize the WIC program along the lines that we all discussed. And similarly, the council did a fantastic job of passing great urban ag legislation. But again, the devil's in the details, and implementing that legislation has been really, really hard. And we're 4 years out from that passing, and the first urban ag plot is just hitting the street. So bravo and kudos, but
it just takes so much time. We have to move faster.
We need to move a lot faster,
sure.
and a lot, and do a lot more in the same amount of time.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Lauren.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, one of the things that urban ag legislation did was provide tax incentives to developers that were sitting on, you know,
massive
empty lots.
Property.
You know, so mm-hmm. I think we're always, you know, and I was just sitting here thinking, am I just talking about altruism? And I really think that my approach is much more, you know, using the vernacular of the sector that I'm working with and trying to find a return on investment for that sector. And, you know, I think that we're in a fortunate position where if we just think creatively together, we actually can find those wins on all sides. And, you know, I think that having the city as a strong partner really prioritizing these kinds of issues so that there are tax incentives put in place, so that there, you know, that there is a benefit to a developer that's going to make a decision that has these other kinds of benefits. I mean, that's what we're all trying to push on.
Beverly, is that something that you at DC Hunger Solutions work closely with the government to do, to sort of help? Do you help them help you? How do you work with them?
So, yes, we're here to help you, help us, help them, help
right.
all
what
of
movie
us.
Is that from? Help me, help you.
So one of the things I was thinking about when we were talking about this, when we first did the grocery store study in 2010, we recognized the food deserts, and we were, once again, in collaboration, came up with the Feed DC Act. Do not ask me what the FEED stands for. Okay, so, but the Feed DC Act was designed to give incentives.
I know what the F stands for.
Economic development.
Okay. To have grocery stores come in, and we were going to give them incentives. And wow, yay, wonderful. So we fast forward 2016, we do the study. We then find out that in the areas where we needed grocery stores, it's actually gotten worse. In the areas where they really didn't need grocery stores,
so many.
They are flourishing. When we sat down and actually talked to retailers, what they said basically, and Lauren, you'll stop me if I'm wrong, is that we were going to build where we were going to build, and the incentives were icing on the cake. So they weren't going where we wanted them to go anyway. So that didn't deter us. What we said was, okay, we learned.
Right.
Now what are we going to do?
Okay.
Can we do incentives for smaller footprint stores? Can we do it, you know, for co-ops? What can we do in order to do that? And that's one of the things that we work with the district government on.
Okay.
With our partners.
And Philip, how does that apply to you?
Well, I think it underscores what we were talking about earlier, the broader economics of grocery store
right.
retail. a property tax incentive is great, but it's not going to change the gross revenue.
Right.
It's not going to change the buying power in the community. It's not going to change the business model.
But since that's not your priority, does that allow you to open up more stores in these regions?
Yeah, I mean it creates space for a social enterprise, for an entrepreneur who sees value in providing, you know, what my business partner would call a essentially non-discretionary line item on the household budget. I mean, these are dollars that are being spent in the community where the flagship or the original Good Food Market's location is in Ward 5. There was $16.2 million leaking out of that community every year in grocery spending. Now, are we grossing $16 million a year? Absolutely not. But are we capturing, you know, a reasonable percentage of that and serving a additional benefits to the community? Absolutely.
Well, the other challenge is site selection, too. If you're near a metro, if you're near a bus line, if you got parking.
Mm-hmm. All those things matter a lot. And, you know, going back to, you know, 2010, the Feed DC Act, you know, at that time, if you overlaid the food deserts map with the commercial zoning map, there were very few places in which you could even open a grocery store.
Sure.
So again, the time frame here being 8 or 10 years, now there is talk of having a deputy mayor for food or some kind of...
I believe we started that talk here.
I think that started here.
Handing out autographs.
I'm nominating you.
A department of food and agriculture, something that think systemically about this. You know, I think the next step, because tax incentives only work to a certain degree, is to start to think about how you can support entrepreneurs in the areas where you want to see economic activity take place. Mm-hmm. How do you sort of incubate those folks who can then go and operate a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5,000 square foot store, whether it be a grocery store? There's all sorts of other, you know, retail uses.
Well, the food incubators that are out there right now are another concept that could, you know, benefit the communities as well as benefit these young, or not all young, but, you know, these craft artisans who are creating new products. I mean, it could really go hand in hand for everybody. Yes, Beverly.
I'd like us to see us use some of the money that we want to do for grocery stores. I'd like to see us break that down and use that money to support smaller businesses in neighborhoods, to support entrepreneurs, to support exactly what you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. In order to do that, rather than go after the big guys who have plenty enough support somewhere else, let us support ourselves in our city. Mm-hmm. And we can do that if we just stop spending money on other things.
But, you know,
back your WIC money.
Well, they have no choice. It's the WIC money. It's not like they give it to them and then they have to give it back if it's not spent.
We don't spend it. But if I can get Phillips stores to be allowed to use WIC, if I can get the corner stores, the healthy corner stores that DC Central Kitchen is now running to get WIC, we're going to have a lot more WIC participation and a lot less leakage back to the federal government.
So one of the things I want to talk about before, because the show's going to wrap up shortly, and we haven't really talked about access, like education to the communities. How do you get the messages out to the communities? Beverly, you stated early on, you know, what if I'm a single mom with 3 kids and I work 2 jobs and, you know, I don't have enough time in my day to read the collateral or get the... How do we get in front of the people who need it the most so that they know about these programs and they utilize them?
So one of the things are just outreach and some of the programs. Now is a perfect time because it's political season where there are tons of programs going on, picnics. We can go and do that. What I love, however, are when we're educating the kids in the schools so that they're using... I used to be an educator, and my schools, I used to run charter schools, and we did breakfast in the classroom, one of the first. So just the kids learn about kale. So they go into a grocery store and they go, "Mom, I want kale." And mom's like, "I don't even know what kale is. I don't know how to cook it." But you've got a 5-year-old that's, not only do I know what it looks like, it's that, and I can tell you how to cook it.
Right.
And we start working with the kids on this in a lot of ways. They will move you forward.
You know, for us, we've started what we call community inReach, where mm-hmm. we're basically hiring folks who live in the communities that are already really passionate about this. I mean, you know, one of my best examples is Miss B, who we met, you know, at a farmer's market. And she was with this big group of people, and we were like, oh, you know, these all your friends, and they're like, we don't even know this lady. She just pulled us off the bus because she wanted us to come to this farmer's market and get $10 in produce plus. She was so passionate about making sure that her community knew about these things that were available
That's
to them.
Amazing.
And so we hired her.
Right.
And you know, and you know, finding those folks that are already champions inside of their community. And for us, it's been the grandmas. You know, you're talking about the kids. The grandmas, you know, like that is a generation that knows how to cook, that mm-hmm. remembers what fresh food tastes like, that remembers when there were, you know,
community grocery stores
in their neighborhoods that were sources of community. And so for us, you know, we started a market champion program where we've been hiring, you know, folks who live in Deanwood, folks who live in Anacostia, you know, who are basically sort of like, we put them at the various farmers markets across the city that are in their neighborhoods,
mm-hmm.
and they end up being like the market mama that, you know, welcomes people. And, you know, I think that
they're the greeter.
They're the greeter, and then they're telling you about recipes, and they're, you know, during the week making sure you're going to be there, and they're making it feel like a community. Because too often, the farmers markets that are set up in low-resource communities are conceptualized as food access points. And then you lose all of the things that make a farmer's market
well,
so
it
good.
It should be no different than a farm, like than DuPont or Penn Quarter or any of the other farmer's markets, which have become total hubs for communities.
That's exactly right. But what's happened is, you know, and this is related to what I was saying earlier about urban agriculture. In D.C. particularly, farmers markets were sort of put in by developers as a sign that a neighborhood was up and coming.
Sure.
And so the folks who live there started to see farmers markets as almost a death knell for affordable housing. And, you know, and so what we've been trying to do by really, you know, hiring the community and making sure that the feeling of the markets reflects the community needs, that there's channels for, you know, for customers to really have an influence on how the community, how the market is shaped. We're trying to push back against that.
I think that also has a lot to do with the kind of product that is sold and the way that people, the farmers engage within that community as well. I mean, it all goes hand in hand with each other. And, you know, I think it's so funny to think of it from a real estate perspective that a farmer's market is some sort of amenity to where you live, but it really is. People brag about their farmer's markets, right? But it does sort of show that a community is being pushed out. But you do know that the government, the DC government, works very closely with the local farmers markets organizations, and they want those farmer markets in those communities.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the Produce Plus program, you know, there's $1.2 million that the city's putting towards that.
I feel like we haven't really explained what the Produce Plus program is.
Sure.
Can you explain it?
Yeah, absolutely. Produce Plus is a program that is funded by the DC government, run through DC Health, and DC Greens is the sort of implementing partner on it together with all of the farmers market entities in the city. And basically, anybody who receives WIC, SNAP, Medicaid, SSI disability, Medicare Q&B, basically any federal benefit can go to any of the farmers markets. They automatically get $10 to spend on fruits and vegetables, and they can go up to twice a week. And we have seen lines
so $10
deep.
A visit?
$10 a visit.
And where is this $10? Is it on a card?
It is actually it's a check. It's a live check. And we run it together with what we call the DC Farmers Market Brigade. So if any of your listeners want to come and be a Farmers Market Brigade volunteer, we have about 400 volunteers that run this at farmers markets in their neighborhoods across the city.
And how do they get this check?
So basically, you come, you show that your qualifying ID the very first time, then you know you're in the system and you get a check. You get $2 $5 checks on site. So sometimes if you've gone to your farmer's market, you might have seen a line of people waiting for something.
Mm-hmm.
What they are waiting for is to be able to get their Produce Plus checks. And what we've found is that because of Produce Plus, we've had about 4 new farmers markets open up east of the river because Produce Plus has secured the market for farmers to actually take a chance
there,
and open
sure.
up
right, and get the money.
And what we found is then, because those markets are now there, they're also, you know, available to cash paying customers. They're available to people who want to spend their SNAP. I mean, it's actually been a driver for environmental shift where it isn't altruism. Again, it's a win-win.
Yes, go ahead.
I would add that Community Food Works has done an amazing job at building what they call a pop-up food hub around farmers markets in lower-income communities to add additional wholesale sales for the farmers, plus what they're getting from the retail. Because, you know, you mentioned DuPont, amazing farmers market. There's tons of amazing farmers markets in the district. But a farmer at DuPont is making about five times what they're making at Minnesota Avenue.
Without a doubt. Right. I mean, it's...
And when I first moved to D.C.
To say it's apples and oranges, I mean, it just is.
Yeah. And so how do you get that farmer to bring the same quality product, the same variety, the same selection, the same customer service? Well, you're going to add $5,000 worth of sales to Community Food Works, who are then taking that food and feeding early childhood education centers. So, I mean, it's literally the best food available going to kids, and it's supporting farmers in the process.
Yes, Beverly.
We're also doing, in some of our farmers markets, summer meals. Mm-hmm. So while the parents are shopping for their, you know, at the farmers markets, we're serving summer meals to some of the kids and taking advantage of that. So it really is an ecosystem and where we're all working together to make this happen.
That's right.
Well, I mean, I think that's, it's amazing. So I guess my big question now is, how do people get involved with each of your organizations? I mean, Beverly, can people get involved with your organization and help you in some way?
Absolutely. They can call us, and we're looking for volunteers. We use volunteers during tax season to help people get on things. I actually had to leave someone today. They called to have volunteers, but I said I had to leave to come on the radio, so I will be calling them back tomorrow morning for their eight volunteers that they want to use for us.
Right. Well, wait. Yeah. Tell us how do we get in touch
so
with you?
So you can actually call our number, 202-640-1088, and my extension is 3014. But if you call that number, you can call anyone, talk to anyone.
Okay, and this is DC Hunger Solutions.
DC Hunger Solutions.
Right, and you have a website?
We have a website, DCHungerSolutions.org.
Okay.
And we also have a Twitter, DC Hunger.
Excellent. Okay, great. And Lauren?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, you know, we run the DC Farmers Market Brigade. We are absolutely recruiting volunteers for that. You have to come to a training, and then we sort of deploy you at whatever market you want to sign up for. So it's very flexible with your schedule. The best way to sign up for that is you can go on our website, which is dcgreens.org. It's under Farmers Market Brigade. You can also write to Mary Alice, M-A-R-Y-A-L-I-C-E, at dcgreens.org.
Is Alice her last name, or does she have two first names?
She has two first
Mary
names.
Alice.
Mary Alice. And she is coordinating the Farmers Market Brigade. We also have open volunteer hours on the K Street Farm on Thursday evenings. And, you know, we have a lot of opportunities. We're the organization that's the backbone for the Rooting DC Forum that happens in February, and we always need a lot of volunteers for that, which is a great urban agriculture forum.
Excellent. Okay. And Philip?
So at Good Food Markets, we have a great volunteer program run by our volunteer coordinator. She's a volunteer who...
Are you stuttering?
Volunteers to coordinate the volunteers. No,
right.
Not stuttering. You can sign up at Good Food Markets, food singular, markets plural, .com. That's my little S.
Okay, so, and tell us where your stores are.
So we have a store in Ward 5, Rhode Island Avenue and 20th Street, Northeast. That's where volunteers can go currently. Next spring, we'll be opening in Ward 8 at South Capitol and Atlantic, and we have already started community roundtables, and we'll be doing more and more. So if you're in Ward 8 and you want to volunteer around that effort, we will also have a 700-square-foot community space that we'll be programming along with the ANC and community groups. So we're starting to think about how we can bring summer feeding programs with DC Hunger Solutions, how we can bring educational programs to that space. So big tent, plenty of opportunities to volunteer. You can email volunteer@goodfoodmarkets.com or go to goodfoodmarkets.com.
Excellent. Yes.
I think the big tent is really the theme here. And I think I really want to underscore that, you know, we are all in very close collaboration, not just sort of conceptually and not just around our mission, but really daily. We really are synchronizing with each other. We're thinking about each other. And I think we're trying to really just elevate this issue across the city.
Well, with good reason. It is an absolute crime that the city has the sort of food desert and food issues that we have. Yes, Beverly?
Can I just say one thing?
Absolutely.
26% of the families with children in the District of Columbia face some form of food insecurity. Mm-hmm. 1 in 7 households, 20% of our seniors. Those are the numbers that we're working with. So we need to take care
America,
of them.
Across America, it's 40 million people, 16 million kids.
But we're
working. You want to make America great again? Feed everybody.
Let's feed everybody. Yeah. No, well, we want to thank you all for your time today. This was such an incredible conversation. So thank you so much for joining us. And we want to thank all of you for listening today. This is David and Nikki Nellis. It's Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast in the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.